This meeting of the House Committee on Veterans Affairs, and we're glad you're here today. Today is Tuesday, February the 1st, and we have two bills plus an informational meeting on today's agenda. If there are individuals here who would like to testify on any matter, we hope you'll sign in on the sign-in sheet over by the poster that says until they all come home. We always appreciate participation.
Don't drink that water. I was here when I got there.
Want to recognize our veterans today and let you know that we appreciate you. And we'll ask veterans to raise their hands, if you will, please, and let us know that you're here today. And we certainly are grateful for your service to our country. And just a quick reminder, and I guess I've already violated it, but I hadn't gaveled in yet, Representative Boquist. When I used the word MOBE earlier, was told that was an acronym. So we do continue to support the use of the full meaning of words versus acronyms, and those who, like me, who decide to desecrate my rule. I need to contribute to the Veterans Fund, which is the basket by the door. Thank you for being here.
Madam Chair, I would tell you which acronym has been the most resourceful for us, the most lucrative.
Oh,
but
which one?
25 cents.
Okay, well, go ahead and tell us.
I think VA.
VA, okay.
It's the most lucrative acronym.
Okay, so those who really want to contribute, use that a lot today, will you please?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll committee members and our audience, we will now open a hearing on House Bill 2135, and I hope all of you brought your bill with you. And Mr. Administrator, what do we have today?
Yes, ordinarily I'll be happy to summarize the bills for you at the start real quick, and then you can go to witnesses to further describe it. This is House Bill 2135. It extends to National Guard members called into active federal military service the benefits that are currently limited to National Guard members called into active service of the state by the governor. HB 2135 clarifies that official military leave for up to 30 consecutive months does not constitute a change of circumstances with respect to the terms and conditions of a joint custody order. This bill declares an emergency and would be effective upon passage.
Thank you very much, Jim. Do we have testimony regarding House Bill 2135?
We have a sign-up sheet, and the only witness who has signed up is Colonel Caldwell.
Thank you very much. Okay, we'll call on Colonel Mike Caldwell at this time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Hey, Madam Chair, while he's getting ready, we might have to get him caught as often as Mr. or Colonel Caldwell is here in this room. He seems to be here every day.
Yeah, he does, and I'm grateful. He has such a huge background. He's just been a tremendous source of information. We're grateful that you're here.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and for the record, and Colonel Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. And I see you got a couple extra chairs on the end here. If you want me to take one of those, Representative Boquist, I'll be happy to do it.
Colonel Caldwell, if you're worried about the vote, I wouldn't be too concerned.
Well, actually, I'm not. It's just they look awfully comfortable chairs, that's all. Making an observation. Madam Chair and members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Colonel Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. House Bill 2135 was pre-filed by the governor on behalf of the Oregon National Guard. And the 2003 session ORS 399-238 was modified to allow Oregon National Guard soldiers called to state active duty by the governor the ability to seek relief from obligations or liability incurred by the members before the period of active service beginning. It allows the court to grant relief in the terms of obligation or liability, which has not been materially affected by the call-up or the duty. Relief under this statute would normally be for a stay in civil judicial proceedings, interest, including service charges, renewal fees, or other fees or charges associated with obligation or liability, interest rates in excess of 6% per year, and modification of a joint custody agreement, only when the court determines a change circumstances in the best interest of the child, but not due to the inability of the soldier's absence due to the call-up. That's on page 2, line 41, for 30 months, or page 3, lines 1, 2, and 3. After this legislation was passed, we realized that we had adequately protected Oregon National Guard soldiers, but we did not adequately cover members of the Guard and the Reserve in the event of federal call-up under U.S. Code Title 10, if they're called up under that code. This bill, we feel, will provide for that coverage and accomplish what we set out to do in 2003. So that concludes my testimony, pending any questions you may have.
Thank you, Colonel Caldwell. Are there questions of the Colonel? Okay, if not, I will now close the hearing on House Bill 2135 and open a work session on House Bill 2135. Do we have a motion? Okay. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we send House Bill 2135 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Thank you. Is there any discussion? Representative Barnhart?
The only thing I wanted to say was that I would like to suggest that whoever works on these staff measure summaries change the wording in the staff measure summary because there's an ambiguity. In the second sentence, it currently says, clarifies that official military leave for up to 30 consecutive days does not constitute a change of circumstances. I think that we ought to call that what it says in the proposal, and that is active duty.
Yeah, that's confusing.
Active military duty, official military duty, rather than leave. I think the summary is accurate but misleading. otherwise, would be a strong supporter of this bill. The sections in it make a great deal of sense to me as a person who used to conduct custody evaluations as part of my psychology practice. I think it's the section on the end of page 2 will reduce the amount of mischief that could occur in those kind of situations, and so I support it.
Thank you. Other discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Boakley.
I would just point out that really what this bill does is it brings the state statute into the exact compliance of the federal statute. Yeah. And under federal service, you're covered by all this, but now under state service, you're going to be covered. So this is actually a very good case where it cleans it up, as Representative Barnhart says, so it levels the field.
Thank you, Representative Boakley. Other discussion?
Representative Pump. I totally am in agreement with Representative Barnhart, because when I read the preliminary summary, then I got confused, and then, it was totally, we need to change up that wording to make it so that we all understand what we're voting on, or else people on the floor, when we get to the floor, may say, what are you guys talking about?
We concur, and thank you.
I'm sure the person who writes that SMS has taken note, and that change will be.
Is that you? I'm sorry. I tend to put people on the spot. I'm sorry.
Your staff doesn't mind at all.
Better you than me, Representative Comp. I would be afraid you'd quit, And
I'll bring brownies on Thursday.
Okay, that will help. Any other discussion? I would just like to interject that I think this is a very important bill. Last year attended a court hearing that very impacting to a family. A father who was in almost 20 years was being sent out. And he had worked for years to get custody of a daughter from his first marriage. He had remarried and had an excellent home near grandparents. But upon his orders the wife of this, his first wife, the wife of, or the mother of this child, decided that since he was not going to be in the home any longer, that this little child who had been stabilized greatly, had improved in school, had changed totally for the good, should return to her. And, I mean, it took a court action to prevent that from happening, so this little child could stay in the home she wanted to stay in with her new brothers and sisters and continue to prosper. So I think it's very important. Any other discussion? Okay, if not, will the committee staff please call the roll?
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Boquist.
Aye.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Hunt.
Aye.
Representative Conk.
Aye.
Chair Nelson.
Aye. The vote is unanimous and the motion passes. And if it would be okay with this committee, just as a chair, this one time I'd like to be the carrier of this first bill from our committee, unless there's our objection. Thank you very much. I will close the work session on House Bill 2135. I will open a hearing now on House Bill 2136. Mr. Administrator, can you tell us about House Bill 2136?
Well, let's see if the Administrator did any better describing this one. This is House Bill 2136. It does have a subsequent referral to Judiciary. House Bill 2136 revises the Oregon Military Department's court-martial terms, procedures, and penalties. It revises the rights of persons subject to court-martial proceedings, including procedures for granting of commutation or pardon by the governor. It authorizes the Adjutant General to convene courts-martial. It establishes a three-judge Armed Forces Court of Appeals for Oregon within the military department to be substantially similar to post-trial reviews under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It prohibits unauthorized persons from wearing any official uniform of the organized militia. It authorizes transfer of regulation-making authority for the state militia from the governor to the adjutant general. It deletes male gender restriction from the definition of unorganized militia. It also declares an emergency would become effective upon passage.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Administrator. And do we have testimony regarding House Bill 2136?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is, again for the record, Colonel Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. With me today is Major Mark Ronning. Mark is our Staff Judge Advocate for the Oregon National Guard. This bill, very well done by your committee administrator. I could almost say, take what he said and run with it. It was very, very accurate and very complete. This particular piece of legislation was again introduced by the governor at our request. Under the Oregon Revised Statutes 398, primary statute, the Oregon Guard has a body of law that regulates how we adjudicate military law in the state of Oregon while we're in state status under the control of the governor. As we mentioned before, we have Title 10 and Title 32 statuses. Title 10 is when the federal government calls you on federal active duty. Title 32 is a federal status while you are under the control of the governor. And then we have a third status called state active duty, which the governor then can call us to state active duty, and that third status under the control of the governor as well for emergencies and other things that the governor may want us to do. This body of law deals specifically with military justice that normally would be associated in the military terms of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. If we were called to federal duty under Title 10, that's what we would be under, Uniform Code of Military Justice. The federal statute cannot apply to acts or offenses committed while in the state status or federal Title 32 status of the United States Code. In an effort to maintain consistency with the Federal Uniform Code of Military Justice, we found it necessary to update our state code, and this bill does that updating along with some other updating that we needed to have done in our other statutes that regulate the National Guard. I have listed, if you want, Madam Chairman, I'll go through them, but there's 27 issues here, and I'd be more than happy to go through all of them. But it clarifies the term of confining authority, if it's okay with you.
Please.
Okay. Clarifies who may convene a court-martial. Allows the Adjutant General to call a general court-martial in the Oregon Guard. Current law only provides that the governor can do that. Requires the state judge advocate to be in good standing with the state bar for appointment. Requires the state judge advocate to meet the qualifications for judge advocate under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Clarifies confinement standards. allows confinement in a county jail at no cost to the National Guard, clarifies pay forfeiture and confinement punishment defined as active duty days or drill days, which was another major clarification in the law to make sure we were, if the court sets some fine, that it was understandable what that fine should be. Clarifies active duty pay versus drill pay for the purposes of punishments. Increases the monetary fine of a general court martial from $500 to $500 from $200. Increases the monetary fine of special court martials to $250 from $200. Increases the number of days in confinement by special court martials from 100 days to 365. Details punishments allowed under the summary court martials. I pointed that out on page 10, line 9 to 17. Provides for the governor the ability to commute or pardon for all punishments imposed by the entire chapter and the rules of the process for a pardon or commission or commutation, excuse me. Allows the adjutant general to promulgate regulations to detail a military judge. Current law requires that the governor do so. Increase the fine for refusal to appear to testify from $500 to $2,500. Relates contempt charges in ORS 33.015, same as civilian courts, and allows confinement in a county jail at no cost to the Oregon Guard for the contempt. Allows a military judge to release a person confined for contempt. Deletes reference to certain drugs by name and allows punishment for the use of manufacturing, distributing, or introduction of a controlled substance. Makes the unauthorized wear of any official uniform punishable by a Class B misdemeanor. Allows the Oregon Guard to use statewide and nationwide criminal records checks for new recruits. Currently, we use the law enforcement data system, and without this change and probably some federal changes, we can't legally use the NCIC, which is the National Criminal... I don't know the acronym. I know it's NCIC. So I owe you a quarter.
50 cents, Colonel Collins.
Okay, National Crime Information Center. Thank you, Mr. Willis.
Oh, good.
Which is gives us the ability to check multi-state. We don't have that with the law enforcement data system. All we have is Oregon, and we need the ability to check multi-state. Establishes a court of appeals in the Oregon National Guard and sets rules for the same. Requires any felony charge be presented to the appropriate prosecuting civilian authority and allows 90 days for the civilian authority to act before a military court can take jurisdiction. Clarifies the military department's ability to make regulations within statutes for general operations and the Youth Challenge Program. Clarifies the adjutant general may make regulations for holding an arraignment. Clarifies that for a case order for review by the state judge advocate, that no less than three commissioned officers must be on a board of review. Requires the adjutant general to specify when regulations become operative. As you can see, this bill changes a good deal of the current military law, but the majority of the changes deal primarily with giving the adjutant general the ability to call a court martial, not requiring the governor to be the sole authority. Also clarifies many parts of the current law and provides for punishment for someone wearing a military uniform. Finally, the other major part is it clarifies the time-honored ability of the military to make regulations that govern our actions and behavior. This has been questioned by legislative council, and this is an excellent time, I think, to make these changes. We currently have used our current statutes as our ability to make regulations. They say the wording is fuzzy, it's not clear. This clears it up. And I want to apologize to the committee, but there are some minor technical changes that we do believe we need to make with the bill, and we didn't recognize them until some other of Mark's colleagues got through it, and I know it's got to be referred to judiciary as well, so I'm not sure about the process. I defer to Jim on this, but one of the changes would be that we have a redundancy in page 3, line 5, where we have the military council and it requires a judge advocate be in there. It's redundant because the governor already has to appoint the judge advocate, which also becomes part of that, you know, the governor's appointment to the military council. So, at any rate, we would appreciate perhaps maybe not a referral out today, or look for some suggestions on cleanups that we just noticed after the full body of judge advocates. How many do you have, Mark? 5, 6, 7 judge advocates that had an opportunity to go through it. And I know it's hard to believe, but 7 lawyers got together and didn't agree. So so we would like that opportunity to maybe make one more shot at it. I found it stunning. It concludes my testimony.
Thank you.
Two more lawyers in the room.
That's right. Thank you, Colonel Caldwell. Questions of the Colonel? Representative Barnhart.
Yeah, I would just note that it only takes one lawyer to disagree. 7, of course, means you have a number of disagreements. The question I have is, are there any of these changes that you're talking about, things that are other than technical corrections, any of them have substantive value to them that we ought to consider? And the reason I'm asking that question is it something that we need to fix, or is it something the Judiciary Committee can do when we send it to them?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, I would say no. They're rather minor. The major components of this bill is one that the governor is not the sole ability, doesn't have the sole ability to call a courts martial. That's a significant piece, and that's not going to change. We're not talking about changes there. And the fact that we had not had a specific reference to unlawful wear of the uniform. We had statutory language that said you can't do it, but it didn't really say what happened if you did. And so we needed those pieces that were very substantial in here. And probably the third piece was the regulatory piece that I mentioned earlier. And that, again, we believed in the statutory language that we currently have, that's been there since, I don't know, Christ was a corporal, I guess, but it's been there forever, that we make regulations. And as you know, most state agencies make rule. There was a conflict in the legislative council's mind between rule and regulation. Now, some of that is the words of art, I suspect, but they wanted it clarified, and I said, fine, we'll clarify it, but that's what we do. And, I mean, it would make very little sense to me that we would be out in the military organization, given the rules that we work with, which are both federal and state, under the control of the governor, but most of our regulations are federally generated and we follow them. And we may adopt them as state regulations or state rules, and in that sense, we're not set up, nor would it be, it would be against the tradition of our organization in the military, that suddenly we would start holding rules hearings, as say ODFW does, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, for the things that we do.
Yeah.
Is that 12 and a half cents?
That was in the same breath, so okay. That's acceptable. A follow-up by Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Well, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to have two different sets of rules that people have to follow depending upon whether they happen to be activated by the federal government or working within the state. So that makes a whole lot of sense. Let me ask you a specific question, though, on the things you mentioned at least twice, the issue of confinement in the county jail and how it is that you don't have to pay for it. It's a compound question. Who does pay for it, and how often does it actually come up that you would want to confine somebody in a county jail? Give us some sense of the frequency of that.
Mr. Chairman, or Madam Chairman, Representative Barnhart, I've been at this now for 34 years in the Oregon National Guard. I don't recall ever having anybody locked up in my memory. In the fact that it's an Oregon revised statute, it's no different than any other Oregon revised statute. If somebody is violated it in a certain extent, then law enforcement authority has the ability to lock up in the county jail. I know that some of our judge advocates, who are both circuit court judges and district attorneys and you know, have their other walk of life, I think this was a major concern of theirs, and I'm going to defer to Mark to maybe he can add something more to that. But to answer your question specifically, I threatened people before, but and that seemed to get the job done, but I never did, to my knowledge. I don't know that we've ever locked anybody up. Do you have any idea of that?
Sir, I've been in the Judge Advocate Corps.
Would you identify yourself, please?
Yes, ma'am. Major Mark Ronning. I am the full-time JAG officer for the Oregon Military Department. I've been in the JAG Corps here in Salem since 1997 now. The threat is hollow when a commander says, you need to show up or else, because we have no confinement facilities of our own. And as we're going into the Title 10 active duties of the federal government, we generally have a period of state time before that. And so when we go out to grab the AWOL soldiers, unless we have everybody staying in one location, or we already have everyone on duty in one location, we don't have anywhere to threaten the soldier that we're going to grab you and hold you until we can take you away. And so essentially it's been a hollow threat that commanders have attempted to use. Now, within the Oregon National Guard, we have many, many, many policemen and sheriffs and local law enforcement officials. Okay? And they're very knowledgeable on how the system works. So they help us into grabbing the people, and occasionally, you know, they will know when there's some spaces around and they can just put people in there. But like Colonel Caldwell said, we haven't seen it happen because it's a hollow threat and we don't have the ability to go do that at this point.
I might just add a little anecdotal story of a young man that I had in my battalion when I was battalion commander, and he had finished his college and basically taken all the benefits that we had offered to get him through college and done very well at it, exactly what we wanted to do. And we recruited him under the college monies and everything else. He came up, he had 4 months left, annual training was in July, and his estimated time of separation was going to be in September, and he was a medic, a very highly high-skilled young man. We spent a lot of money on him. He was going off to get his nursing degree, and he'd gotten his nursing degree, he was going on to PA, and it's great. He was doing everything we wanted. Well, medics are like hen's teeth. We just simply never have enough of them. We cannot run any kind of a range, a rifle range, a tank range, mortar range, you name it, without a medic on that range. And I was desperately short of medics. I only had a handful, and I needed this young man real badly. He informed his commander in Pendleton that I'm not going to AT. He said, I'm going to be out, you know, and I know how many AWOLs I can get before I get thrown in jail, yada, yada, yada. And he said, so I'm not going. So I drove to Hermiston. I was on my way to La Grande anyway for this drill, the last drill before I ended up training. So I went to his boss, and he was working in a pizza joint. I called him my pizza man. And I told the boss, I said, is this guy's your soldier, right? And he says, well, I said, he has to go to AT. And he said, well, no. He says he doesn't. I said, well, let me put it this way. And I also called the sheriff, and I had him meet me there. I knew the sheriff. So he met me at the pizza joint. And I said, I will guarantee you better plan on somebody being here for 2 weeks, because he will not be here. He may not be with me. He may be with the sheriff, but he will not be in your pizzeria. And you know what? The kid showed up for AT. A nice visit. Sheriff and I went and had a nice cup of coffee, and I made my point. But like Mark said, it is a hollow threat, and I got the sheriff to support me on that. And that helped because I knew the sheriff very well, and I made a point of knowing that in my battalion area. I knew every sheriff, knew every chief of police. Because unfortunately, our young men sometimes are a little, they have a reason or a cause to be involved with local authority on occasion. So it helps to know the local authorities.
Thank you. That's a very thorough and beautiful answer to my question. Thank you, Colonel.
Any other questions of the Major or the Colonel? Representative.
Thank you. Oh, go ahead.
Doesn't matter. Thank you, Madam Chair. Colonel Caldwell, I'm a little bit, maybe I just need clarification on this, a little bit concerned about the item regarding the military uniforms, however, and my concern lies with the high school kid or the college kid who wears a uniform, a battle dress uniform, maybe unbuttoned, and we could have a whole discussion about whether that's respectful or not. Sometimes we know for a fact it's not respectful, but I would argue sometimes it's done out of respect as well, but it's certainly somebody who's not in the military wearing a uniform. Would that be pulled into this situation? I read the bill, and the bill is a little bit ambiguous. It's the top of page 14, and it starts off talking about no member of the organized militia shall wear, but then it goes on from there and talks about, in my interpretation, anybody wearing. Now, without splitting hairs, does it also mean we're talking about the kid in Halloween who has a real uniform?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Bruin, I think the key word here, again, I think it's a word of art, but it's the word official uniform. Somebody wears a battle dress uniform that they got at the secondhand store. I've had old uniforms that I sold in garage sales. They were old. They were no longer in style. They had rips in them, whatever. And people love to buy those sort of things. And officers have to buy. We buy all of our uniforms. They're not provided. We have to purchase them. And when we say official, when we talk official, we mean that they've got name tags, they've got designations on them, they've got rank, patches that indicate either your units and or certain qualifications that you hold. Mm-hmm. And that's really what we're talking about. And you may have noticed in the newspaper here just recently, one of our guardsmen, who's also an Oregon State policeman, had a young man who had been recruited, who had never gone to basic training, never gone to advanced individual training. It was a private E1, shows up. I don't know where he got the uniform, but he got an E6 uniform on with all of his medals and ribbons, and et cetera, to make a complaint to the Oregon State Police. Unfortunately, he didn't realize that the Oregon State policeman he was talking to was also a National Guardsman who had just come back from Iraq and had spent a year in Iraq with one of our units. And he took real offense to this because he looked at the uniform and immediately knew that this young man was not official because he didn't have the ribbons in the right spot, didn't have the name tag, and he had badges and other paraphernalia that simply didn't add up to a kid his age. That happens. He arrested him under the current statute. He arrested him. Or cited him. He didn't arrest him. He cited him and released him. But that's what we're talking about. When we say official, we mean when you try to make the uniform indicate something that you're not.
Can I follow up, Madam Chair?
Yes.
So you would say that it's when the attempt is to misrepresent yourself as either active in the military or having achieved a status within the military that doesn't truly represent the situation.
Madam Chair, Representative Bruin, yes, I would say that. I would also say, and we've had other incidences through the years where Oregon Guardsmen have misrepresented the Oregon Guard, for instance, in this body, have put on their National Guard uniform that was appropriate in their rank and everything else, but came down to represent a cause or a certain thing without our knowledge and without any approval from us, which then indicated to the legislative body that they were somehow representing the Oregon National Guard. And that's an official, again, authorized by law or regulation, may not wear an official uniform. Here again, they misrepresented themselves in the body that they are a member of. So I suppose it could also fall into that. But typically, it's when somebody purposely tries to mislead somebody else in an official capacity. Go ahead. Mark has a comment.
Oh, sir. Ma'am, sir, and as a full-time representative, I receive a lot of telephone calls from community members. Mm-hmm. One telephone call I received approximately a year ago was that a lady says, in my apartment complex, in the middle of the night, there's a guy running around in a military uniform. Okay, it was a full official military uniform, but he was a security guard for the local security company, and he just thought it was more cool to go around in a military BDU to do his security guard dodging behind bushes at nighttime to protect this building. Well, this woman, you know, understandably thought that it was the military that was out there taking care of issues. We have no authority over that civilian. And this bill will not give that to us. But we have no ability over that civilian to make him stop doing that. This gives the local law enforcement the hammer to say, no, you can't wear that unless you are authorized to wear that uniform.
Right. Madam Chair. And I agree with that point. A situation like that, here's a gentleman in a position of authority that's clearly attempting or certainly not arguing against the fact that he's misrepresenting himself as a person in the military. My concern, once again, is not that case. My concern is, once again, the case of the kid in high school or college who may have an official uniform, but it's not out there to, you know, it might be untucked or unbuttoned. And once again, I don't want to, I mean, the respect or disrespect of that is a whole different issue. And I find it disrespectful completely. But there's, you can go to any college campus in Oregon and find a dozen kids on any campus on any given day that might qualify under this. And that's my worry, that we you know, create an issue that there isn't any right now. I don't know how to address that necessarily other than to voice the concern. That would be my concern.
Thank you. Representative Hunt.
That was exactly my concern.
Okay.
Great minds think alike on this end.
Okay, any other? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On this point, I note that the issue that you raised, Colonel, about the person who is a member of the Guard coming to the legislature and testifying wearing his uniform would not be covered by this proposal because there's a specific exception under under on line 10 for people who are current members of the organized militia. Or actually someone who'd been discharged to wear their uniform or retired. So I think the example you give us would not be covered by this statute. Do you disagree with that?
Madam Chair, Representative Barker, I do. It says in line 7, yeah, a person who is not authorized by law or regulation, mm-hmm, on to line 8.
Right.
So without that person getting authorization, then they would be in violation. They would have to have authorization.
Well, I would respectfully note the language on line 9. Unless the person is one of these other things. It would seem to me that would be an exception to the not authorized. Have I misread that in some
way? Well, and maybe that's part of this cleanup we need to do.
Yeah. And
let me look, 396.105. Let me just look it up real quick. Representative Barnhart, the JAG officer agrees with you, so I'm going to defer to the lawyer who can agree to that.
Madam Chair.
Barnhart, did you hear his response?
I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, I do agree with you, sir.
Yeah.
Yes. Because we already have the authority, if it's someone who is in the National Guard, we already have the military authority over them to take care of any acts that they should do that are improper while in uniform. So this does not address those issues. This is...
That's already covered. This covers other situations.
I can already prosecute that, Roger.
I got you. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Boquist.
Yes, Madam Chair. First a statement, then a question, I guess. Obviously, we need to clean up this clause regarding uniforms. It's really targeted at those individuals who impersonate members of the militia. There is, correct me if I'm wrong, Major, there is a federal statute out there that actually covers this in some degree, too. So it's not actually a new concept. It's a kind of a cleanup concept. The actual second question I would have... is can you give the body, if the major could kindly give the body, just a brief background of the 7 other fellow compatriots of Representative Barnhart who are civilian lawyers who reviewed this, so the body here would get an idea and a feel for the legal review that it went through at your level before presenting it to the committee.
Yes, sir. Ma'am, sir, we undertook this project approximately 2 years ago. We started with a full analysis of the Oregon Code of Military Justice. In the JAG Corps, and as traditional soldiers, we had 2 circuit court judges. We have our state judge advocate, Colonel Warren, represents Oregon cities and counties. We have a deputy district attorney, and we have a variety of civilian attorneys generally do prosecution. Approximately 2 years ago, each of us took the current code and went our separate ways and did a complete scrub of it. I went overseas. I was stationed on the Egyptian-Israeli border, and I had 6 months of time on my own doing the job in my spare time to sit down and do a scrub. We all came back together, and we put our heads together on those scrubs, and we had several months of coming together and analyzing. Then we finally came down with a final product, and we met with Legislative Council this past summer and went with Legislative Council and did another scrub, and we had a series of meetings with Legislative Council. After Legislative Council scrubbed our scrubbing, then we all got back together again for another 2 sessions and went through it. And the changes that Colonel Caldwell addressed are minor changes. For example, it says court when it should say courts. It says active duty base pay when that's not exactly a correct term because sometimes they may be on a traditional soldier pay, so we want to change that to just pay. The final scrubs are very minor technical details just to make sure that, you know, the way our processes work in the military justice system. And our intent by doing this was to get rid of the problems that we have from soldiers' perspectives and commanders' perspectives in trying to determine which jurisdictional law they are under at any given time. Because if they're on state active duty or if they're a traditional guard weekend and then they go active duty, it's changing and the rules are changing. So our intent is to incorporate the Uniform Code of Military Justice through regulations so that the punitive articles, the law that says this is what, if you do this, you'll get punished, will apply in all 3 circumstances.
Thank you. Any other questions, Representative Boquist?
Just one follow-up. Unlike the kind Colonel Caldwell, I did put soldiers in jail under this law. the key element of this where you can actually jail someone in a jail is that in order to detain them, for example, it's not proper for on state active duty for you to go out to their house and arrest them and bring them back. And so what you find is you're trying to even get someone back to retain, to get back state equipment or federal equipment or things like that, you have to get them to come to the armory or the unit. And what really has to transpire is you've got to get a sheriff to agree to go out and under this code, which they can do, arrest them. But then the question the sheriff also says, who's going to pay to keep them overnight? Because they'll go out, they will not go out during the daytime during patrol generally. They'll go out in the evening when the things are slowing down. They'll get the individual, bring them back in, and then they will deliver to you or you can pick them up the next morning so that we can recover, in many cases, thousands of dollars of U.S. and state property from them so that then you can process them out. And I know in Hood River County and in Wasco County, that was always a big issue from in those days in 1989 of who's going to pay the $75 to house the guy overnight so that we can recover $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 worth of equipment that belongs to the government that we're, of course, as stewards of taxpayer money trying to get back. And so, I mean, that's really kind of the key using factor. It's like Colonel Caldwell said, where you can kind of browbeat them, but occasionally you do, in order to retain, to get the taxpayers' money back, you've got to do this. And it was always an issue of who pays the $75 to put them in jail overnight, or it was $75 just to process them in. Even if they brought them to the jail and processed them in, they wanted us to pay $75 to get them, you know, back for them, even on the site right there. And so it was a useful tool in many cases in ours with recovering, you know, I would say in excess of $10,000 to $12,000 in equipment that belonged to the taxpayer.
And did you pay that?
We generally, once I paid it myself because I was not going to pay for the reported survey, and in several occasions, the good sheriff in Hood River County, you know, did in fact say that they would waive the $75 charge. But not all counties of the 36 counties now, in fact, fiscal times will do that.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Okay, if not, I'll close the hearing on House Bill 2136, and I'll open a work session on House Bill 2136. Do we have a motion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Farr.
I move House Bill 2136 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Judiciary by prior reference.
Is there any discussion?
Madam
Representative
Chair,
Barnhart.
The only question I have is whether we ought to address any of these issues ourselves or whether they're the ones that ought to go to Judiciary Committee. I think I'm satisfied now that they probably ought to go to Judiciary Committee, and so maybe I'm answering my own question. I have some of the concerns that have already been raised about this, about the misdemeanor on page 14, and I assume that can be noted for the Judiciary Committee discussion. Okay, thank you.
It can be, Representative Barnhart. Okay, any other discussion? Okay, if not, we'll have committee staff call the roll. Okay.
Representative Bilquist.
Yes.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Conk.
Aye.
Representative Bernhardt.
Aye.
Chair Nelson.
Aye. Okay, the vote is unanimous.
Madam Chair.
You didn't get called, Representative Hunt. Doesn't H come after the chair?
Whatever.
Aye.
Thank you. The vote is unanimous, and the motion passes, and House Bill 2136 will be referred to the Judiciary Committee, and notes will be made by our good administrator of the changes that need to be made. And I want to thank the good colonel and the good major for being here today to answer our questions and give us input. And I can't think of anything better for that Judiciary Committee than to have seven more lawyers come in and testify before them. And I think we want to be sure that we know of that day so we can
be there.
Lawyer Day. Thank you. I will close the work session on House Bill 2136. Thank you so much.
Put my dollar in the back.
I will now open an informational meeting. Jim Willis, our director of our Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs. Will you come forward, please?
Well, good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm back here today to do some follow-up based on my testimony before the committee on January the 18th with some answers. And, well, I think that's the best way to say it, with some answers. They're not as good as, some of them are not as good as I would have liked. Let me just say that. So with your permission, Chair Nelson, I'll get right to the answers here.
Great. We're pleased to have you.
Thank you. On that day, I was asked by Representative Hunt if we knew how many of our mobilized veterans were homeowners versus renters. And I've determined that we do not know that. That information is not gathered. But the third part of your question, we do know. And that is how many would be eligible, at least initially, for an Oregon State Veterans Home Loan. And so let me tell you how that process works. In order to apply for an Oregon Veterans Home Loan, you have to have a Department of Defense Form 214, which is your separation document from the armed forces. That document begins the process. And then we turn into and are authorized loan originators around the state, the mortgage bankers and others and brokers who are authorized to begin our process, then turn into a normal loan organization. And so then there's the need to do a credit check and that kind of thing to further establish the eligibility. But everything begins with the Department of Defense Form 214. So I asked staff to do some research on that to kind of give you a picture of those eligibilities. And so the eligibilities we looked at were from July 1 to December 31 of 2004, so the previous six-month period. During that time, 2,343 of the 214s were entered, or in other words, filed. Now, of that, our staff sent out 1,375 welcome home packets. That packet is very similar to the one that was provided to the committee by our office that tells you that whole list of benefits and so on. The reason that there's a difference between the 2,343 that were filed and the 1,375 that were sent out was because, one, some of them had already received the information and we were aware of that. Two, some of them were discharged under dishonorable conditions and therefore we would not send the information. And some had already established their eligibility for the loan and therefore they didn't need the information. So, now, of that number that received the welcome home packets, then we get those who come in to establish their eligibility for the loan. And so, again, from July 1 to December 31 of 2004, 44 individuals who were discharged prior to December of 76 established eligibility. And that's important, of course, because of requirements on us with regard to how we can use our monies. And you remember the eligibility date being December of 76. So we call it pre-76 and post-76. So I'll get back to that in a minute. I know it's confusing because it was to me. So there were 44 who were discharged prior to December 76. There were 86 who established eligibility that have been discharged since December of 76. Three of those are Iraqi freedom veterans who have established eligibility and are now simply waiting for their Department of Defense Form 214. So they're waiting to separate from the military, and then they can go ahead and process for their state home loan. Now, we have at the department two pots of money, I guess is the best way to say it. We have some monies that can be loaned to those individuals who were discharged prior to December of 76, and then we have other dollars that can be lent to those who were discharged after 1976. And you'll recall that I talked to you about the qualified veterans mortgage bond funding that we were using to sustain the program almost since its inception in 1945, and the fact that that money is no longer, we're no longer able to sell those bonds because of a change in the IRS tax code in 1984, which is where the December of 76 limiting date came from. That's in the federal IRS tax code. So how do we still have some money for the people who were discharged prior to December of 76? The reason for that is when we have return on our bond sales, if that money is what we call pre-Allman money, Allman being a name associated with the legislation that occurred in 1984, that pre-Allman money that we have can be used to make home loans to veterans who were discharged prior to December of 76. It's a limited amount of dollars, and when it's gone, it's going to be gone because we don't have any bonds that are, very few bonds that will be able to supplement that fund source. And then, of course, we have a limited amount of money left to fund the post-December 76 loans, which is why we're working very diligently with our congressional delegation and the other four states that I mentioned in my testimony to amend the IRS tax code and to allow us once again as a state to sell the qualified veterans mortgage bond so that we can replenish the fund source and continue to offer Oregon's state veterans home loans to those qualified veterans. So I've tried to answer that question on how many are eligible as best I can by giving you a window. And if the best way to say it would be initially, at least initially, and until we start the loan process, the potential of eligibility for that six-month period was 1,375. So I'll pause there, Madam Chair, and let's see if that generated more questions than it answered.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You indicate that there's some limited funds available. Could you give us a better sense of just how limited it is? I mean, for example, will the 86 people who were discharged after 1976 who applied during that period be able to get loans, and or will you run out of money before you're able to process those? Give us some sense of where you are on that. And as another piece of that, it would be really useful, I think, for me, if it doesn't take too long, to describe very briefly the business aspects of this system. I mean, I know you have overhead expenses, you have interest you have to pay on bonds.
That's correct.
As a business enterprise, how's it doing? Is it paying for itself? Those kinds of questions. I think you get the gist of what I'm asking.
I do, Chair Nelson and Representative Barnhart. We could do this one of two ways, and I'll certainly leave it up to you as to how you want this done. I could have my chief financial officer come in and give you the exact amounts. Okay, then I'm going to give you my director's layman overview of how it's been explained to me and how I try to explain it to others. If you in fact loan this money to veterans over a long period of time at low interest, which is the whole reason to have established the program, and at the same time when you pay interest on the bonds that was higher at the time that you sold them, then you subsequently loan the money, then you're receiving interest on the loans you made at a lower rate than you're paying on the bonds that you sold. We have some bonds like that. So what we did in the last period of time that I've been director is we sat down and looked at this long-term strategically and said, okay, what is it going to take to zero out the now deficit loan program? And at that time, we felt like we could get 0-0 on the program in 2006, which isn't, you know, too far away. That is predicated, however, on any other demands from the fund source that may be made because of shortfalls in other parts of the budget and so on. But right now, our best estimate is that when we did that calculation, that we could zero out the loan program by 2006. That doesn't mean it's making money, but it doesn't. But it does mean it's not losing any money. I hope that answers the question.
That answers a piece of it.
Okay.
What about these applications that you've got in hand now, and are you going to be able to service those or not? And if so, maybe you've asked one more wrinkle. Raised one more wrinkle.
Okay.
What is the comparison between the interest rates you're going to have to charge and the interest rates that these former soldiers could get just going out into the market?
Okay, let me answer, Chair Nelson, Representative Barnhart, your question. Let me answer the first part first, which was, are we going to be able to make the loans at all? Do we have enough money? I feel fairly confident that in the pre-76 situation, depending on how much the veterans want to borrow, that we could meet that demand. I am less sure that we could meet the demand for 86 new loans if the mean average cost of a dwelling today across the state is $175,000 or more. You know, I don't know that. I'd have to talk to someone who is in real estate or somebody that knows those figures better than I do. But I know it's very expensive today to buy a home. So I'm less sure on the 86 eligibilities for the post 76 loans on whether we could sustain it. And I apologize, but the second part of your question,
the last piece is a comparison between the rates you need to charge in order to come out on this and what they could get in the market.
Chair Nelson and Representative Barnhart, because we had to protect our ability to pay what we owed on the bonds, when the national economy and certainly Oregon's economy in the last couple of years, last 2 years I would say, went south on everybody, and it was a terrible situation, the mortgage lenders, mortgage bankers, were able to loan at a rate lower than we could go because we could not get below what we needed to have in order to pay our indebtedness. Now, today, and I haven't looked at market today, but I believe we're now where we belong, which is below market. Maybe by as little as half a point, but over a 30-year loan, that's a lot of money.
Yes, it is. Yes.
So right now we're doing what the loan or what this program was established for in the first place by the legislature, and that is to offer a low interest loan to a qualified veteran. We're there today. Now the economy fluctuates, and I worry every time there's testimony about loan rates. By Mr. Greenspan. You know, every time Mr. Greenspan goes to the Congress, I think anybody who's in the loan business holds their breath. Unless he says, of course, the right things, but he tends to be rather independent persons, and he should be, I suppose. But that's my best answer. I'm sorry.
Mr. Jim, mm-hmm. Can these veterans refinance? Let's say they went with the commercial banker and now want to come back because our rates are lower. Are they allowed to do that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, they can refinance their state veterans home loan, and in the economy that I just mentioned, where they could refinance the loan at a rate lower than we could offer, many of them did, causing our portfolio to shrink.
And can they do the reverse?
What it had been. Can they do the reverse. I'm sorry.
They've gone with a commercial banker outside of the Veterans Administration.
Now you're
offering a point, half a point or a point lower. Do you allow them to come back and refinance with you?
Madam Chair, they can come to us and seek a loan for an existing property, and we can make that loan. What they cannot do, and this is a real challenge to our loan program, is we can't refinance an existing ODVA loan. So, as an example, when all of this happened and the trends changed in the interest rates, that's one of the reasons we lost all those loans, because we're prohibited from refinancing.
Representative Boquist?
Yeah, Madam Chair. I'm curious. Yesterday in revenue, our eyes glazed over in the Revenue Committee, but we passed a bill that increased the, out of committee, that increased the level of affordable housing bonding authority. And the review of that program showed us that, one, it had lower foreclosure rates than normal programs, that it was solvent and it was working. I'm just wondering if the various agencies like your agency is at least occasionally meeting with other agencies like the Affordable Housing Commission to kind of compare notes to see things that they're doing that makes them more efficient, or maybe you more efficient, or back and forth, because we see so much disparity in state government between agencies, and we know that the Revenue Committee, at least, that they're doing a decent job of them. Their bonding authority raised, and they will be going out and bonding more money to provide affordable housing. Does that sort of discussion go on between agencies, and are you constantly looking for improvements in the veterans program despite federal impediments?
Thank you, Representative, Madam Chair, Representative Boquist. We are members of the State Bond Council, and so anybody who has bond authority meets on a regular basis to look at the economic health of the state with regard to its bonded indebtedness. That's number one. Number two, our next door neighbor directly across the street on Summer Street here in Salem is the State Agency on Housing and Community Development, or Community Services, excuse me, headed by former Representative Bob Repine. And Bob and I meet a lot and talk about the general health of housing in our state. I've met, and I noticed that the committee got information on this, about housing opportunities for offender veterans who are attempting to come back into the community, become reemployed, and so on. And we've worked with them and with housing on low-cost housing for those folks, for homeless veterans, and for the unemployed. So the answer to your question is yes, we meet and talk, and I have no pride of ownership of this program, and if I hear something that somebody else is doing that works, then within the law, we're going to try it. And we have some ideas about how to take care of our ability to continue to offer a state home loan program in the event that we're not successful in changing the IRS tax code. And there's a couple of really good ideas out there, and you'll have to trust me right now. They're not completely gelled yet, but as soon as they are, I'll be happy to testify about them. And they came, Representative Boquist, from those kinds of discussions, and where we went to other people who are pretty smart in this business and said, what can we do in light of all these challenges against our long-term program? And people said, have you tried this? Have you tried this? Have you tried this? And some of it we can actually do. Others, either it's prohibited federally because of the way we use our money, or it's prohibited by state law. And then some of the good ideas actually come from our originators, which wouldn't surprise anybody. I mean, they don't win when we fail. So we're going to listen to every good idea, or every idea, and hope it's a good one, and try to strengthen this program. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions?
Madam Chair, I have one last question back on definitions, since it's going to come back to me if you indulge me.
Yes, please.
You made mention that the Department of Defense, which is commonly acronym DD-214,
right,
was the triggering mechanism. Can you shed any light, and I'm totally clueless on this myself, is that
National Guard Bureau form, an NGB form, is issued to members of the Guard for their Guard service. I know in my personal experience, my DD-214 from Iraq covers all that Guard service, but that's a fluke of events. I went to Iraq and it's there. My question is that we have many soldiers who have been on, and I'm going to explain the acronym, ma'am, but what is termed in an order ADSW funding, which is active duty special work funding, on 179-day tours to two examples in the state, guarding Umatilla Army Depot so no one destroys or steals nerve gas, right, and sitting on the flight line at the Portland Air National Guard base in the cockpit of an F-15 ready to defend this country. Those are two missions that are happening today, and many of that is done on 179-day tours. And I think, I'm not sure, that they get National Guard Bureau forms, and so therefore they would not qualify under the definition you gave. Is that correct, or can you shed some light on this?
Chair Nelson, Representative Boquist, that is exactly correct. And we have talked with the Oregon Military Department about that very issue. That issue and one other. So let me answer the first one. It simply doesn't meet the criterion that's currently in statute and regulation with regard to who we can make a loan to. But as important, secondly, is when these mobilized soldiers come back, and let's say they're on a 6-year enlistment with the Guard, and they've got 3 more to go when they return from mobilization, we can't currently make a loan to them because they don't have a 214. What we could do, is to talk at a national level with my colleagues about the fact, because we're using so much active duty reserve component and guard, Air and Army Guard, I think we need to find a way to use the existing code, that same IRS tax code, which we're trying to amend anyway, mm-hmm, to allow us to use forms other than the 214 to allow them to get their home, because it really puts these folks off until they actually separate from their total time, and then we hope that they had the time in mobilization to meet the veteran status. Most would today, but like you said, on the other ones, where there was that number of days that was, and I guess we all know why that was being done, it was wrong, but that's a challenge. Mm-hmm. But I think we can fix that. It's simply pointing out to people, they served, what's fair, what's the right thing to do, and so when you amend the code to allow the funding, when you amend the code to extend the 30-year eligibility to a realistic date for the future, then you ought to also at the same time look at the definition of veteran in terms of real numbers that are being used on thousands of people who already served.
Jim, does a family, a widow, for example, does she qualify for this loan?
No.
At the current form time. 214 given to an individual.
Oh, okay. Pardon me, Madam Chair. We think, and I'll get the answer for you this on, I was thinking the remarried people. If there is an unmarried spouse of a deceased service member, they may qualify. I'll get you the answer, though.
Thank you.
And I'm sorry. I want to make sure we're right about this.
Yes, you may carry that out further, knowing a situation, which I do, just how about the surviving children? Should the mother be deceased also? Representative Belquist.
Madam Chair, Jim, could you you're pointing out the fix for covering more veterans, mm-hmm, that are deserving of benefits is an issue that has to be fixed in the IRS Internal Revenue Service tax code.
Right.
Never get through a day yet without the pain. That's a federal fix. What would happen, hypothetically, if the state definition was changed to say something like 178 days of of active service, would there be an impact at your level in the Department of Veterans Affairs?
Chair Nelson, Representative Boquist, there would be an impact on those things that are simply predicated on the 180 days plus and when that was fixed. But those that are tied to the federal definition would not change. So I really think that we could do some good by doing that with some state benefits, but it wouldn't touch the whole arena of the benefits until we fix it at the federal level.
Madam Chair, I would be interested in a later point of following up and being able to divine for the committee if the committee did fix or thought it best that, you know, we moved it back to 178 days, which takes care of the quirk that everybody's using in the law since 9/11 of I guess I'll say it frankly, screwing over soldiers, that what would we fix and what would we not fix? And then I think later at a point then we could figure out is what we could do at our level and what we could encourage our congressional delegation to do at their level.
I think that would be excellent.
At some point. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Dan.
All right. Thank you, Chair Nelson. Vice Chair Farr asked me specifically about Kathy Bell, who was a woman veteran that had a little bit of difficulty gaining employment, as I recall. That information was then passed on to Mr. Jim Booker, who you've seen at least twice here, I think, testifying from the Oregon Employment Department. I know they're efforting some information about that now. I'm not aware if Jim's gotten back to you on that yet, but I know he's testified here again. With regard to a couple of suggestions and questions that the committee had specifically through Vice Chair Farr, and that was on the issue of employment rights awareness, and were things being done to either increase that or make people more aware of what their rights were as a veteran? Was there a space for veteran status on their forms? As it now turns out, yes, there is. But there needs to be, and I believe Jim concurred with this, Jim Booker, a more affirmative move in these interviews to making sure that the employment personnel themselves understand these people are veterans and then can move them more toward their employment benefits that way. So I appreciate Mr. Booker helping me with the answers. Madam Chair, Representative Comp, we had a discussion about how the vets access the health care program and how far they had to travel. I think we pretty well established how far they have to travel because of Oregon's geographics and how many facilities were actually available to them, and how we all hope that we can work out something in the federal system, especially in large states like ours with 91,000 square miles, that people can access local health care with a government covering the cost so that they don't have to make those long, long drives. And I think in the testimony of Dr. Tuchmet, I think he touched on some of those issues on accessing, and so did Regional Director Jerry Larang. So I hope, Representative Comp, that helped.
That's great.
All right.
It did. I had written a few notes here, and that's exactly what I needed.
All right. Thank you very much. And finally, Chair Nelson, looks like she may have to leave.
Excuse me, Director right. Willis, if you'll pardon me, I just must go testify for a constituent, but Representative Farr will continue. And thank you for being here.
Yes, you're very welcome, Madam Chair. Okay, then I hate to do this, but I want on the record, I now would like to answer Chair Nelson's questions. But I mean, that's just how it worked out. It was the last.
We'll take it.
Okay, it was the last one. She asked a very good question with regard to insurance coverages. I believe what she was referencing was health insurance primarily, and was wondering if the military department, the Oregon Homeland Security, and perhaps even the Federal Homeland Security, and law enforcement could somehow pool their resources and come up with insurance program that would benefit all of them. And so I simply would say that that question, because we do have a Homeland Security Department here in Oregon, should be posed, I believe, to the to people like Colonel Caldwell from the military, to Director Beverly Vanell of Homeland Security, and then to the Superintendent of the State Police, Mr. Ricker, and then to the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, OSSA. I think between that conglomerate, they could give the chair an answer about how it works today, and then is there a possibility of bringing that umbrella coverage together. And the other option, of course, at the state level is to ask Director Thorne from the Public Employees Benefit Board, called PEB, if she could help the committee there with that sort of that global coverage of the state health system. So that would just be my suggestion. And finally, Chair Nelson asked about the number of homeless veterans, the number of unemployed, and then about drug treatment programs. Fortunately, those were answered by previous witnesses. Mr. Booker covered the homeless and the unemployed. The drug treatment question was raised to Dr. Tuchmet about the ongoing substance abuse treatment programs that are being offered through the VA and how they're being used. And those were the final questions of the chair of me. So, Vice Chair Farr, that concludes what I had for you today.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to make a statement or address the committee? There being no further business to come before the committee, we are adjourned.